Imagine for a moment that you are standing in a long queue at an airport. You are holding the small booklet, your passport. A uniformed officer looks at it, looks at you, and then nods. You are allowed to pass. That small moment, ordinary as it seems, contains one of the most powerful ideas in all of human history. Someone gave you that passport. Someone decided you belonged to them and they to you. That someone is not a person. It is not even a building or a flag. It is an invisible, permanent, and enormously powerful thing called the state. The state is the central idea in political science, the study of how power is organized in human societies. Almost everything about your daily life is shaped by the state. The road you walked on this morning was built by it. The school where you learned to read was organized by it. The money in your pocket was printed by it. The police officer on the corner gets their authority from it. And yet, most of us have never stopped to ask, what exactly is this thing? What makes it real? What does it do? And what happens when it fails? To answer these questions clearly, we first need to do something important. We need to separate the state from two other words that people often confuse with it. These are the words nation and government. Understanding the difference between these three ideas is the first step toward understanding the state itself. A nation is a group of people who share a common identity. They might share a language, a history, a culture, or a religion. The Kurdish people, for example, are a nation. They have a shared culture, language, and identity. But for most of their history, the Kurds have not had their own state. They live spread across Turkey, Iraq, Syria, and Iran. So a nation is about people and shared identity, not necessarily about territory or political authority. A government, on the other hand, is the group of people who are currently in power and running the state. Think of it as the machinery inside a car. The car, the state, stays the same even when the driver changes. When one political party wins an election and replaces another, the government changes, but the state continues. The courts keep operating. The army keeps functioning. The laws stay in force. The government is temporary. The state is permanent. The state itself is the permanent, abstract political organization that holds the ultimate authority, the final power, over a defined piece of territory. It is abstract because you cannot touch it or see it. You can see its symbols, like a flag, and its buildings, like a parliament. But the state itself is an idea, an agreement among people that this particular organization has the right to make the rules that everyone must follow. Now, how do scholars decide whether something is really a state? This is not just an academic question. It has real consequences. Whether Palestine is a state, whether Kosovo is a state, whether Taiwan is a state, these questions affect millions of real lives. Scholars and lawyers often turn to a document called the Montevideo Convention, signed in 1933, which tried to set out the basic rules. According to this framework, a state must have four key elements. Think of them as four legs of a table. Without any one of them, the table falls over. The first leg is population. A state must have people living in it permanently. There is no rule about how many. The People's Republic of China has over 1.4 billion people. Vatican City, the tiny independent territory inside Rome that serves as the headquarters of the Catholic Church, has fewer than 1,000 residents. Both are recognized as states. What matters is not the size of the population, but that people live there on an ongoing basis. These people are the citizens of the state. They are subject to its laws, and in theory at least, they are the reason the state exists. The second leg is territory. A state must have a defined geographical area, a piece of land with recognized borders. This territory includes not just the land itself, but also the rivers and coastal waters belonging to it, and the airspace above it. That is why when a foreign military aircraft enters a country's airspace without permission, it is considered a very serious violation. The state's authority is tied to its physical space. It is worth noting that border disputes are very common in the real world. India and Pakistan have disputed the region of Kashmir for decades. But even with disputed borders, a state can still exist as long as it has a stable core territory that is clearly under its control. The third leg is government. A state must have a functioning government, a set of institutions that actually runs the place. This includes a legislature, which is a body that makes laws, like a parliament or Congress. It includes an executive, which is the part that carries out and enforces those laws, like a president or prime minister and their ministers. It includes a judiciary, which is a system of courts and judges that interprets the laws and settles disputes. And it includes a civil service, the thousands of officials and administrators who keep the daily machinery of the state running, from tax collectors to school inspectors. This is where the idea of a failed state becomes important. A failed state is one where the government has broken down and can no longer perform its basic functions. Somalia in the 1990s and early 2000s became one of the most famous examples of this. After years of civil war, there was no central government capable of controlling the territory, providing basic services, or protecting citizens. Rival armed groups controlled different parts of the country. Piracy spread into the waters off the Somali coast because there was no effective state to stop it. Somalia had people, it had territory, but its government had effectively collapsed. This shows us that a government must not just exist on paper. It must actually be able to function and exercise real control. The fourth leg, and arguably the most important and most interesting, is sovereignty. This is a Latin-rooted word that means supreme power or authority. It is also the most abstract of the four elements, so let us take our time with it. Sovereignty has two faces, like a coin. One face looks inward, and one face looks outward. The inward face is called internal sovereignty. This means the state is the highest authority inside its own territory. No other group, not a powerful corporation, not a church, not a regional warlord, not a foreign power, has a higher legal authority within that territory than the state. The state makes the final rules. It collects taxes. It runs the courts. And crucially, it is the only entity that is allowed to use physical force, violence, in a legitimate, legally approved way. This last point was made famous by a German sociologist. A sociologist is a scholar who studies how human societies work, named Max Weber. Weber lived from 1864 to 1920, and he gave us one of the most quoted definitions in all of political science. He said the state is the entity that successfully claims the monopoly of the legitimate use of physical force within a given territory. Let us unpack that sentence carefully, because every word matters. A monopoly means exclusive control. Nobody else is allowed to do it. Legitimate means it is considered right and acceptable by the people. And physical force means the ability to compel people, ultimately through violence or the credible threat of it. So Weber is saying, the state is the only organization in a given territory that has the recognized right to use force. A private citizen who attacks someone with a weapon is committing a crime. A police officer who restrains a violent suspect is performing a legal duty. The difference is not the physical action, it is the authority behind it. That authority belongs to the state. Now here is the outward face of sovereignty, called external sovereignty. This means the state is independent from other states. It has the right to make its own decisions about its own affairs without other states telling it what to do. This is the principle behind what we call non-interference, the idea that one country should not dictate the internal policies of another. It is also connected to the concept of international recognition, which means other states formally acknowledge that this entity is indeed a legitimate, independent state. The case of Taiwan illustrates this beautifully and painfully. Taiwan, officially called the Republic of China, has all four elements of statehood in a very practical sense. It has a permanent population of about 23 million people. It has a clearly defined territory, the island of Taiwan and some smaller islands. It has a fully functioning democratic government with elected leaders, courts, laws, and a strong economy. And internally, it governs itself completely. Yet Taiwan is not recognized as a sovereign state by most of the world's countries because the People's Republic of China, mainland China, insists that Taiwan is a breakaway province of China and puts enormous political pressure on other countries not to recognize it. Only a small number of nations officially recognize Taiwan. This shows that sovereignty is not just about what you can do internally. It also depends heavily on whether others in the international community accept your status. Taiwan is one of the strangest puzzles in modern political science, a place that functions entirely like a state but occupies a deeply uncertain legal and diplomatic position. Weber's definition raises a genuinely difficult question that scholars have argued about for generations. He said the state claims the legitimate use of force. But who decides what is legitimate? Legitimacy, the quality of being accepted as right and proper by the people, is not automatic. It has to be earned and maintained. What happens when a government uses force against its own people in ways that most citizens consider unjust? Think of apartheid-era South Africa, where the white minority government used police and military force against the black majority population. Most people inside and outside the country considered that force deeply illegitimate, even though it was legal under the laws the government had written for itself. Does a state that loses the trust and acceptance of its own people lose its legitimacy? And if legitimacy is essential to Weber's definition, does a state without legitimacy cease to truly be a state? These are not easy questions, and different scholars answer them in different ways. Now that we have established what a state is, let us turn to what a state does. Across history and across all parts of the world, states have performed a set of core functions. These functions are the reasons states exist, the jobs they are supposed to do. Different political philosophies argue fiercely about how many of these jobs the state should perform and how well, but most scholars agree on a central list. The most ancient and fundamental function is security. Before anything else, a state must protect its population from threats. This means maintaining a military to defend the country from foreign invasion or attack. It means maintaining police forces to enforce laws, prevent crime, and keep domestic peace. This connects directly back to Weber's idea about the monopoly on force. The police and military are the physical expression of that monopoly. Consider the ancient Chinese concept of the mandate of heaven. For thousands of years, Chinese political philosophy held that a ruler had the right to govern only as long as they kept order and protected the people. If the ruler failed to maintain security, if the state fell into chaos, famine, or invasion, this was taken as a sign that heaven had withdrawn its approval and it was time for a new ruler. This ancient idea contains a surprisingly modern insight. States derive their authority partly from their ability to protect their citizens. A state that cannot provide security has a weak claim to the loyalty of its people. The second core function is the creation and enforcement of laws. A state must provide a legal framework, a set of rules, that governs how people in the territory behave toward each other and toward the state itself. This involves not just writing laws but building the entire system of courts, judges, lawyers, prisons, and enforcement agencies needed to make those laws real. This function is enormously important for economic life as well as social life. Businesses can only plan, invest, and operate with confidence if they know what the rules are, that those rules will be applied consistently, and that contracts, formal agreements, will be enforced. A country where laws are ignored or applied inconsistently struggles to attract investment and build a stable economy. The third function is administration and the provision of public services. Modern states are enormous administrative machines. They build and maintain roads, bridges, ports, railways, and water systems, the infrastructure that makes economic and social life possible. They operate public schools so that citizens have access to education. Many states run public healthcare systems, or at least provide some form of basic healthcare for citizens who cannot afford private care. They build public parks, maintain archives and records, issue identity documents, and perform the thousands of daily administrative tasks that keep a complex society functioning. There is a classic example from economics that helps explain why states do many of these things rather than leaving them entirely to private businesses. It involves what economists call public goods. A public good is something that everyone benefits from, and that cannot be easily restricted to paying customers only. National defense is the clearest example. If an army protects a country from invasion, it protects everyone inside that country, including people who have not paid for the protection. You cannot say to one citizen, "Sorry, you didn't contribute to the defense budget, so we won't protect you when the enemy invades." Because of this, private companies have no good way to charge for national defense, so the state must provide it. Similar arguments apply to lighthouses, flood defenses, and street lighting. The state steps in where markets fail or where it would be unfair to let ability to pay determine who gets a vital service. The fourth function is economic management. States play a deep and sometimes decisive role in their national economies. Every state issues currency, the money that its citizens use, and manages the supply of that money, usually through a central bank. Every state collects taxes, money taken from individuals and businesses to fund state activities. The question of how much tax, and from whom, and for what purpose, is one of the central battlegrounds of politics in every country. Beyond taxing and spending, states regulate businesses. They set rules about what companies can and cannot do. Regulations protect workers from dangerous conditions. They protect consumers from being sold dangerous or dishonest products. They protect the environment from being destroyed by industrial pollution. States also negotiate trade agreements with other states, deals about which goods and services can be bought and sold across borders, and at what prices. All of these activities mean the state is deeply embedded in economic life, even in countries that officially believe in free markets. The fifth function is fostering national identity. This is perhaps the subtlest function, but it is extremely powerful. States actively work to create a shared sense of belonging and loyalty among their populations. They do this through national symbols, flags, anthems, public holidays, statues, and monuments. They do it through public education, where children are taught a shared version of history, a shared language, and shared values. They do it through national media, national sports teams, and national cultural institutions. The goal is to make diverse people feel that they are part of one community, that they share something essential with strangers who live hundreds of kilometers away. Benedict Anderson, a famous scholar of nationalism, described nations as imagined communities. He meant that most members of a nation will never meet each other, but they nevertheless feel a sense of connection. They imagine themselves as part of a shared community. The state actively cultivates this feeling because a population that identifies with a state is more likely to obey its laws, pay its taxes, and in extreme circumstances, fight and die for it. This function raises a difficult question in diverse societies. What do you do when a single state contains many different ethnic groups, languages, religions, or cultures? How do you create a unifying national identity without forcing minority groups to abandon who they are? Countries like India, with its hundreds of languages and religious communities, wrestle with this challenge constantly. With all these functions in mind, we arrive at one of the great ongoing debates in political philosophy, the question of how much the state should do. At one end of the spectrum, libertarian thinkers like the American philosopher Robert Nozick argue for what they call a night watchman state. The image is vivid. A night watchman does only one job. He patrols the streets to keep order and then goes home. He does not cook your meals, tell you how to spend your money, or plan your career. Nozick argued that the state should be similarly minimal. It should protect citizens from violence, theft, and fraud, and nothing more. In his view, taxing people to pay for services like public education or healthcare is actually a form of injustice, because it forces people to give up their money for things they did not choose to pay for. At the other end of the spectrum are advocates of the welfare state, a state that takes active responsibility for the basic well-being of all its citizens. In countries like Sweden, Norway, Denmark, and Germany, the state provides universal healthcare, free university education, generous unemployment benefits, retirement pensions, subsidized childcare, and extensive social safety nets. Supporters of this model argue that a person born into poverty, or struck down by serious illness, or thrown out of work by economic forces beyond their control, deserves state support as a matter of basic human dignity. They argue that true freedom requires not just freedom from government interference, but also freedom from poverty, ignorance, and preventable suffering, and that only the state has the capacity to guarantee those things. Both sides of this debate claim to be defending individual freedom, which tells us something important. The meaning of freedom itself is deeply contested. Nozick sees freedom as freedom from interference. The welfare state tradition sees freedom as requiring positive resources and opportunities. This is not merely an abstract argument. It shapes every budget decision, every election, every policy debate in every country in the world. Finally, we must look at the state in the modern world, where it faces challenges that no previous generation of rulers ever had to confront. Globalization, the process by which people, goods, money, and ideas flow rapidly across national borders, has created profound new pressures on state sovereignty. Consider the power of modern multinational corporations. Companies like Apple, Amazon, or Shell operate in dozens of countries simultaneously. Their revenues, the total money they earn, sometimes exceed the entire economic output of small and medium-sized nations. When a government tries to regulate or tax these companies, the companies can threaten to move their operations elsewhere. This gives corporations a form of leverage over states that was barely imaginable a century ago. International institutions present another challenge. The European Union is perhaps the most striking example. Member states have agreed to follow EU rules on trade, environmental standards, working conditions, and many other areas. EU law takes precedence over national law in many cases. This means that France, Germany, Italy, and the other member states have voluntarily given up a portion of their sovereignty, their supreme authority to make their own rules, in exchange for the benefits of belonging to the Union. Whether this arrangement strengthens or weakens those states is a matter of genuine debate, and it was a central argument in Britain's decision to leave the EU in what became known as Brexit. Transnational problems, problems that cross national borders and cannot be solved by any one country alone, are perhaps the deepest challenge to the traditional model of the state. Climate change does not respect borders. A factory in China burning coal adds to warming that melts glaciers in Greenland and floods coastal cities in Bangladesh. No single state can solve this problem alone. The same is true of global pandemics, as the world saw with devastating clarity during the COVID-19 crisis. Viruses do not carry passports, and international terrorism, organized crime, and the dark side of the internet all operate across borders in ways that state-centered responses struggle to address. Some scholars argue that these pressures are gradually making the traditional state obsolete, that the future belongs to international institutions, regional bodies, and global governance. Others argue that this conclusion is premature. They point out that when the COVID pandemic hit, it was states, not international organizations, that made the critical decisions about lockdowns, vaccines, and economic support. They argue that states are adapting to globalization rather than being destroyed by it, and that they remain the primary actors on the world stage. One more challenge deserves mention: the problem of failed states and the question of when, if ever, outside powers are justified in intervening in the internal affairs of another state. The traditional principle of sovereignty says each state has the right to manage its own affairs without outside interference. But what happens when a state is failing? When its government collapses, civil war breaks out, and millions of civilians are killed or displaced. The United Nations endorsed a principle called the Responsibility to Protect, often shortened to R2P, which says that when a state fails to protect its own population from mass atrocities, the international community has a responsibility to step in. This principle creates a direct tension with traditional sovereignty. It says, in effect, that sovereignty is not an absolute right. It comes with responsibilities, and if a state fails those responsibilities catastrophically, the protection of human beings takes precedence over the protection of state authority. This tension was tested painfully in places like Rwanda, where the international community failed to intervene as an estimated 800,000 people were killed in a genocide in 1994. It was tested in Libya in 2011, when NATO forces intervened under R2P arguments to protect civilians from the Gaddafi government. It continues to be tested in Syria, Yemen, and elsewhere. The debate is far from resolved. Let us pause and gather together everything we have explored in this lesson, because we have covered a great deal of ground. We began by recognizing that the state is the central concept in political science, the permanent, abstract political organization that holds supreme authority over a defined territory. We saw that it is distinct from a nation, which is about shared identity, and from a government, which is the temporary administration running the state at any given moment. We examined the four essential elements of a state: a permanent population, a defined territory, a functioning government, and sovereignty. We learned that sovereignty has two dimensions: internal supremacy over all other groups within the territory, and external independence from other states. We saw Max Weber's famous definition, which identifies the state as the only entity with the legitimate monopoly on the use of physical force, and we raised the difficult question of who gets to decide what counts as legitimate. We explored Taiwan as an example of a territory that functions like a state, but whose external sovereignty is deeply contested. We then turned to the core functions of the state: providing security, creating and enforcing laws, administering territory and providing public services, managing the economy, and fostering national identity. We saw that while these functions are widely accepted, there is fierce debate about how extensively the state should perform them, ranging from the minimal night watchman state favored by libertarians to the expansive welfare state model practiced in Scandinavia and elsewhere. Finally, we explored the modern challenges facing the state: the power of multinational corporations, the sovereignty-sharing arrangements of international institutions like the EU, the transnational nature of problems like climate change and pandemics, and the tension between state sovereignty and the international community's responsibility to protect civilians in failed or failing states. The state is not a simple thing, and it is not a finished idea. It is a living concept, shaped by history, contested by scholars, tested by reality, and constantly evolving. Understanding it deeply is the foundation of understanding politics, and understanding politics is the foundation of understanding the world we all share.